The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, good morning. Welcome to our talk. This is an issue that is something that I think is really pressing for us today, not just in terms of our classical Christian education, but also in terms of our culture generally. I mean, I think this is a problem trying to figure out how, for example, liberal arts factors into STEM and vice versa is something that our society is having trouble figuring out, and I think it's doing real damage. So my name is Mitch Stokes. I'm from New St. Andrews College. I teach philosophy, teach science and math there. I used to be a research and development engineer, but then went back and got a PhD in philosophy because of the money. So, is there really such a thing as Christian STEM? And when I say STEM, I'm using the acronym science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So basically, to look at all of the sciences, what we typically talk about in contrast to the humanities. Now that's a shame. Okay, that's a shame that we really have that contrast. But and it's something that we can't do without, but I want to push back against that STEM versus the humanities. So the notion of STEM and classical Christian ed, I mean, as you know, we've come a long way over the last 20 or so years in terms of classical Christian education, and just what a wonderful opportunities we've had, what great advances we've made. I mean, there's really, really a lot of hope here now. And it just, it's been super encouraging as I followed this, and I've been involved in classical Christian education over the last 20 or so years. It's just been fantastic to see all the resources and all the ways we've been in improving. And one of the things that's really good about classical Christian education and liberal arts education in general is this emphasis on the liberal arts as opposed to, and I'm going to say this again, just a qualifier, as opposed to the STEM. There was a historical accident maybe after World War II that our culture and our country in particular, but the West in general, focused much more on STEM. They veered away from the liberal arts as we typically think of them, and focus much more on the doing, on the technology, on the science. So, and again, that's a historical accident. And what we've done, which is as a movement, and I think people are seeing this in general, you have people like Jordan Peterson talking about this, so it's really it's something really fantastic, is we're starting to re-emphasize some of the, what we would normally call humanities, the liberal arts, the history, theology, philosophy, literature, which I think is absolutely crucial. You know, we were in a ditch. But I think what we've done over the last 20 years, it's in emphasizing that, I think we're starting to veer into the other ditch. And I've seen this everywhere I go when it comes to the way either the liberal arts teaches STEM, or particularly the way we as classical Christian educators teach STEM. There's still this, we're not sure exactly what to do with STEM. Now, if I say, all right, is there really such a thing as Christian STEM? The answer is yes. I mean, so, okay, bye. I mean, that's not, you know the answer. The question is really, okay, well, what does that mean? How does it look? How do we do that? It's kind of like, so William Zinsser, he's, by the way, get If you're interested in writing at all, or teaching writing, or even just for yourself, his book on writing well, William Zinsser, he taught at Yale for a while. Anyways, in that book he says, look, he uses this analogy. Let's say you're teaching someone to play baseball. And you say, you know, you're telling the person you're coaching, you say, hit the ball. Well, I know that. I know to hit the ball. I know that there's such a thing as Christian stem. I want to know, how do I do that? What does that mean? So that's the key here. That's what we're focusing on. Just an aside. In the back, I'm getting an echo. So I'm hearing myself twice, and that's definitely too many times. You guys don't want to hear me twice. So I don't know if there's anything we can do about the echo back there. That'd be great. Now, one of the reasons we haven't been able to put the stem together as well as we can, and again, we've made great strides. I don't want to come up here and go, you know what? We're really doing an awful job. We're doing a great job. This is wonderful. We just need to keep moving the ball down the field and growing in this. But one of the reasons that it's hard to put things together, there are a number of things, is that we don't realize that math, science, and humanities grew up together. So that story, and we'll talk a little bit about this today, and I want to go through that. That's one of the things I want to point out to you, is that these grew up together, and knowing that story helps both our understanding of STEM and our understanding of the humanities. In fact, both are hurt if we don't understand this story and how these things are linked. So this is a really critical, critical issue. Just as an aside, the founders of physics, from Newton to Galileo, Newton, all the way up to Einstein, Heisenberg, Bohr, all of these guys who are these visionaries. You know, they're making these big changes in the physics. They're not just doing calculations. They're changing the course of a discipline and even culture. They were classically trained, or what we would call classically trained. They had a broad liberal arts background. Talk more about this a little bit later, but I mean, Einstein was steeped in philosophy, and it affected his physics. So it wasn't just like this an aside that kind of made him a better person or whatever. It was really something that did that, I'm sure. But it also affected specifically how he did physics, and we wouldn't have general relativity, for example, without it. All right. Another reason this is important is that STEM, it really is becoming a legitimate mission field. I mean, this is something that I can't stress enough. STEM folks are going to really become the gatekeepers for much of our intellectual culture and therefore our spiritual culture in the church. And I don't mean just in culture abroad. It's for the church. You know that there are so many issues that we have today that we're struggling with, that we're thinking about. I mean, just think about it, that are all wrapped up in science somehow. I mean, my own story, like I said, I used to be an engineer. One of the things that I struggled with extreme doubt when it came to science and scripture and science and Christianity in general, or theism. It's one of the reasons I went back to school, was to try to figure out this and how they fit together, because if you really don't want to have students running around with these two different compartments of science and Christianity, or STEM and Christianity. I can tell you firsthand, and for the last 30 years of my life coming into contact with people, I cannot tell you how many times this is a life issue. A spiritual life issue. This is a mission field. Now, what I'm going to say is the punchline is going to be, integration. And again, you're going to be like, well, I knew that. I mean, that's kind of, but how? How do you do that? This is very difficult. And the reason it's so difficult is actually a symptom of our problem to begin with. We've been trained, most of us are trained in either humanities of some sort or STEM of some sort. I mean, you know, there's a reason we have these categories. And we've been trained that way. And so have people for decades, for the last century. So how are we going to give people what we don't have? And so this is what I want to give you a broad outline of. Here are some general principles. Here are some things to look at. And then give you some specifics at the end of how maybe you might carry this out. Just so you know, we're not alone, again, in thinking that this is an issue. Oxford, I'm part of this program for Oxford, where they have 25 faculty coming in for an interdisciplinary program where we're all trying to research and learn from one another on science and Christianity and how those really relate at a fundamental level and not a superficial level. So this is not something that is going unnoticed by everyone. This is really, really important. But it's not easy. So the problem is real. You know this as well as I do when it comes to, for example, how does Christianity affect being a car mechanic or a brain surgeon? Or what difference does it make to 1 + 1 = 2? Or F = ma? I mean, I think that's a real struggle for us in when we're teaching STEM, is to try to figure out how do we do this and integrate it in a way that's not ad hoc or hokey. Now, there are obvious links between STEM and Christianity, and I alluded to these before. So there's things like the age of the universe, the age of the earth. Those are obviously big issues. Human origins and evolution. Astrophysics, the formation of galaxies, stars, and planets. I mean, either we've got it totally wrong, physics has it totally wrong when it comes to how these things, how galaxies and all of that are formed, stars, or God made with the appearance of age, or the age of the universe is really billions of years. I mean, there's something going on in here in one of those three categories. Again, Big Bang, origin, evolution of the universe, psychology and sin. We know that that's something that, you know, you really can't understand psychology unless you understand sin. And there's another obvious connection between STEM and Christianity, and that's more the ethical side of things. Like, what are you going to do? How does this help humanity? How does it help us love God? How does it help us love our neighbor? So the motivation of applying science, for example, to the welfare of others, that's a common connection between science and Christianity. I mean, that goes back to even further back than Francis Bacon. You have Robert Boyle and the Invisible College and starting of the Royal Society. And the Royal Society, the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge, it was one of the goals was to improve the fallen state of man. Okay, so there's this drive. So again, there's another obvious connection between STEM and Christianity. But we need to go a lot deeper than that. So here's the question. How specifically does Christianity make a difference to STEM? And vice versa. This is something that I want you to hear. It makes a difference in the other direction as well. Understanding STEM, without it, we're not going to understand the humanities, and we're not going to understand the history of the West. You just can't do it. So this is a this is a both and in the direction, the travel direction is in both ways. Okay, so let's start, as if I didn't already, let's look at the, just real briefly, you know, this is kind of a review for you, but I want us to be on the same page. The liberal arts, classical and classical Christian education. I think classical Christian education, the best way to do that is with a liberal arts education. In fact, I think done rightly, they're identical, but they can come apart, and they do often come apart. But I think a liberal arts education, and what is a liberal arts education? Well, the word liberal, obviously, that's from, you know, it doesn't mean you're not conservative or anything like that. What it means is that you're free. So these are the people who had a liberal arts education, as you know, were the people who were free. And it also, a liberal arts education makes you free. Right, so that's the liberal part. And it's not, you know, sometimes, well, you as you tell people that you teach at a liberal arts school or whatever, people tend to think that the liberal arts is just this watered down education. But in fact, it's the opposite. When done correctly, it's way more difficult, way more rigorous. And it's not just a vocational training, it's training how to think, and it's going to include math, science, language, literature, theology. But the point here is that it's broad, it covers a lot, it's integrated. The different parts, the breadth that it covers is not the superficial, shallow understanding, it's deep. So they're connected, they're deep, and it's broad. Now, if you look at those three, yeah, no, that'd be great. It's kind of one of those, yeah, I saw this on a machine shop once. You can have it cheap, quick, or with high quality. You choose two. You can't have all three. But it's like, okay, you can have broad and integrated, but you can't have deep. We look at that and we think that that's impossible. But it's not, it really isn't. There are some simple things that we can do that are very high yield. Now, that does mean, though, that we're going to have to, you know, there's only so many hours in a day, right? So we're going to have to leave some stuff out. Every teacher, that's just such a painful lesson to learn. To know, there's so much I could be covering. So highlighting, finding those sweet spots requires, if you're going to identify those sweet spots properly, you yourselves have to be broad and deep and integrated. So we're not. This is not something that is easy. So again, we'll talk about the solutions, integration. It's about understanding the big picture and not just the details. But it's not just the big picture. It's both and. Right, you have to understand the forest and the trees. If you leave either of those out, you're missing so much. For you math teachers, think about how many concepts are poured on the students. Think about your own math background. It's really hard to see how it all fits together sometimes. Well, not even sometimes. You know, it seems like a grab bag of concepts. But when it comes to science and the humanities, one of the things I want you to take away from here is that the history of the West is bound up in the way science and philosophy and math grew up together. Here's an odd person to quote, but I think Alexander Rosenberg, he's a philosopher of science, very, very good philosopher of science, a Hume scholar. He's got a book, The Atheist Guide to Reality. He's one of the few that are really trying to make his atheism consistent. Very interesting thinker. But here's what he says. He was struggling with these questions, and he was in physics, or he was in philosophy, then I think he went into physics, and then He was trying to find the answers to the big questions. He says this, imagine how troubling it was for me to discover quite soon that the history of philosophy was mainly a matter of great minds wrestling with science. At least from the beginning of the 17th century onward, the agenda of every one of the great philosophers, and he's not overstating it, the agenda of every one of the great philosophers has been set by advances in physics and chemistry, and later also biology. This was one of the things that surprised me when I went back to get my philosophy degree, is how much, you know, here you are reading Immanuel Kant. Good heavens, he started out studying Newtonianism. That's a whole thing that got him interested in philosophy to begin with this Newtonian physics that could accomplish so much. And you couldn't understand the philosophy without understanding what was going on in the scientific revolution and why it was so critical. Now, Rosenberg says it goes back to the 1600s. It actually goes all the way back to at least the beginning of ancient Greece. So back to the 600s BC. And this is called sometimes called the First Enlightenment, when you get this birth of Western philosophy. So I want to take a look at that. I want to take a look, and this is actually the story of liberal arts. Later today, I'm giving a talk on calculus. I'm going to go through it with a different set, but there's a lot of overlap here. But there'll be some. I'll be filling it in from different vantage points. So this story of liberal arts, if we look at it, it begins with the problem of change. So going back all the way to someone like Thales, you know, 580s BC, first philosopher, first scientist, first mathematician of the West. That's kind of that's a pretty big calling card. Now, the Greeks were observant. They were thoughtful. They looked around. And they saw there are lots of things in the world, lots of different things. And these different things are changing. They're changing from some things to acorns to trees to, they're constantly moving. And so there's this problem that we can really characterize the history of the West, at least in terms of philosophy, as is the problem of change, trying to get our hands or our heads around this unity or this diversity and trying to unify it conceptually. So why is, today we have a unifying story, at least in terms of, let's just talk about physics, we have a unifying story. All the physical stuff is made up of quarks, and electrons. And they're held together by these four fundamental forces. I mean, there are other fundamental particles, but everything that the physical world is made of is quarks and electrons. Do you know how unifying, we tend to overlook how amazing that is. There is no reason that it should be that simple, that there shouldn't be chair molecules, person molecules, shoe molecules, computer molecules, or whatever these fundamental parts are. Or even, look, there are no kinds of particles at all. Every single particle could be entirely different from all the other particles. That'd be a big hassle. But the fact that we've unified it, so what we've done is we've answered some of these questions that the ancient Greek philosophers were trying to answer. Now, what they were looking for is called the arche. We get monarch from that. It's overarching, unifying principles. Sometimes it's a stuff. Sometimes it's kind of an idea. It's not always clear. Sometimes it's very, that's philosophy for you. It can be ambiguous. So you have this arche. And Thales, I said, he's the first, he's our first scientist, philosopher, mathematician. His answer is that everything is made up of water. So that's his arche. water. Now, by the way, I'm just giving you the history of philosophy right now. So this is as important, as fundamental in philosophy as you get. Arche, for him, everything's made of water. Now, that seems kind of strange and kind of cute, but there are good reasons for thinking that water might be everything might be made out of water. You need water for life. It exists in three phases. There are different reasons for thinking this. But the answer itself, though, is not the issue. The real key is the kind of answer, the kind of question they were asking, and the kind of answer they were giving. So other philosophers gave maybe air. One philosopher gives something called the boundless, the apeiron, the unlimited, whatever that is. But they had these different answers of what binds, what unifies all this diversity, what accounts for all the change. But we automatically think, well, yeah, we know why an acorn grows into a tree. It's made out of the same stuff, and they have this design. Actually, we don't really have it all down, just so you know, but we think we do. We think we have this kind of, we know how it works. Now, of course, this is an aside, but it's a very important aside. For us, the arche is Jesus. So in Colossians, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or rulers, or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Now, I'm not just... You might think, oh, well, you're making this connection between arche and Jesus. That's something that's kind of forced. But look at what John 1 says. In the beginning was the Word. It's really in the arche was the Logos. The arche was a loaded, powerful, fundamental term. It didn't mean just like the beginning of time. It's a foundation. So one of the things that we need to, and this is just an aside, I'm not going to flesh this out, but Jesus is the arche, and again, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean, and how does that apply here? And it's different from Jesus being the physical stuff. You know, he's not made of subatomic particles, nor is he a subatomic particle, so he's not making up this computer or the chair or you or whatever. But I wanted to point that out. Okay, so Thales and some other people came up with this notion, these answers to the arche. Then you get to the Pythagoreans. Pythagoras is so underappreciated. We know him only for the theorem that he didn't even invent. You should name your children more, like at least a middle name, Pythagoras. That's what I'll be doing over the next few minutes, is arguing that you should name your child Pythagoras. Now, it's all started with this notion, this kind of revolution. And this is where we start getting into STEM more deeply. The notion of strings. The Pythagoreans are looking at these strings and noticing that they can be characterized mathematically with octaves. Like these mathematical numerical ratios. There's no reason, I mean, we're not surprised by it anymore, but there's no reason that the world ought to be that user-friendly. That something like math and the whole numbers should go together like that. And yet they do. And the Pythagoreans were so impressed by this. Just put in the back of your mind right now this notion of strings. We're going to come back to strings towards the end of the talk. So the Pythagoreans say this. They say all is number. There's this cosmos, which means beauty, ethical. We get the word cosmetic from the same word, cosmos, this harmonia, this fitting together of the parts. And this fitting together of the parts is kind of like chords. You have the individual notes that come together and they make harmonious music. They don't lose their individuality. And that kind of harmonia that they're talking about was all numerical, numbers. This is one of the most important insights that humans have ever devised. Now, it would have died probably with the Pythagoreans had not Plato himself been a Pythagorean. He was trained by the Pythagoreans, not just Socrates. He traveled, was trained, very interested in mathematics. In fact, he was fundamentally this Pythagorean. We see this in the Timaeus. The Timaeus was probably the most important Platonic dialogue up until maybe the 1800s. And it's basically Plato's creation account. But the creation account is everything's fundamentally geometrical, mathematical. All the stuff that you're sitting on is ultimately triangles, actually. Tiny little, this is atomism. But more than that, Plato set this homework problem for the academy that we're still going through today. And it's this. Look, you look around the universe, or you look around the sky, the night sky and all of that, and you see all of these moving bodies. You see the sun, the moon, the stars, and planets. And it seems like they're pretty straightforward in terms of their motion. They're pretty regular, but they're not at all. It's actually very, very difficult to characterize the motion of the heavens with mathematics, with circles or whatever it is. It's just really, really difficult. And so what Plato says is this: look, guys, ladies, gentlemen, please, what I want you to do is I want you to go off, do a homework assignment, characterize the heavens using mathematics. Now, the reason that he could do this, I mean, to us, we're like, yeah, whatever. For him to say that is amazing, because there's no reason to think that that would be possible. There's no reason at all. The only reason we think there's a reason is because we're used to it. This is one of the things that I continually try to impress upon my students. It's so hard to get anyone excited anymore. You know this. I mean, once we're used to something, it's hard to make it like, wow, that really is amazing. Then there's the... So there's the Timaeus. There's also the Republic. I'll talk more about this in the afternoon session. When it comes to math, what's really strange and disconcerting is that Plato wanted his philosopher kings to study mathematics for 10 years. And that's in order to train their minds. It's kind of a sanctification process to get their minds off earthly things and on abstract things and to think things that, and it's really to purify the soul. This was so critical and very Pythagorean. In fact, and also in the Republic, by the way, is where we get our notion of the liberal arts, which is a Pythagorean concept as well. We have the trivium, which is the languages. But then the quadrivium, the geometry, arithmetic, music, and astronomy, those were just the Pythagorean divisions of mathematics. Now, I'm not suggesting, and this is one of the things, we can talk about this maybe if we have some time, I'm not suggesting we teach the quadrivium per se. I think there's great insights there, but I wouldn't say, all right, in order to teach liberal arts, STEM liberal arts, we need to include the quadrivium. I think we ought not do that necessarily. But STEM is hard. Math is hard. And so there were some concepts that were difficult when it came to change. I'll talk about those later in the afternoon session. But we didn't have the mathematics to actually do, to characterize all of this motion. So basically, we just had to put that off. It left kind of a vacuum. Aristotle came in and filled that vacuum and looked at the world more organically, more like a biological entity, and we had that for maybe the next 2,000 years. It's not that mathematics just died off or anything like that, but this problem of change was much more difficult than we could have, we ever thought. So you have this qualitative aspect for Aristotle rather than this quantitative, until the scientific revolution of the 1600s. The scientific revolution of the 1600s, it's a revolution, because it's an overthrowing. The reigning king of science, Aristotle, is being overthrown. And he's being overthrown by people like Galileo and Newton, who are doing what? They are bringing mathematics this Pythagorean Platonic view. By the way, Copernicanism was often called Pythagoreanism, Platonism, Neoplatonism. It's this reintroduction. This is one of the things that you can one of the ways you can characterize the scientific revolution as is it's a revival of these Pythagorean Platonic views. I cannot stress that enough. They were consciously aware of this. They were doing this on purpose. It wasn't something that happened by accident. The other aspect of the scientific revolution, we're not going to talk about this, but it's very related. It's the mechanical philosophy. Rather than looking at the universe as an organism, it's much more of a mechanistic view, though ask me about Newton sometime. It's much more of a mechanistic view that's amenable to mathematics. So those two are going hand in hand. But you have this, remember what I'm doing. I'm going through just this real quick overview of history, of intellectual history, and showing how these the problem of change in STEM is a theme throughout. So you get Newton, and he invents the calculus. I'll throw this out again, just as a side. I think everyone should learn calculus at some level, not just as a in order to do the problems, but in order to understand this problem of change. I will talk about that later, but I just, this invention of calculus that Newton and Leibniz made is why our culture thinks the way we do today, why we take science so seriously. Calculus is this culmination, Newtonian physics is this culmination of Plato's problem of change that started thousands of years earlier, that the Pythagoreans, the Platonists, would have never imagined. This is why Newton was seen as almost a deity. If you look at some of the odes written to him, it's embarrassing. I mean, he'd probably be rolling over in his grave if he heard some of these things, akin to Jesus and a Messiah figure. But this is not an overstatement. He's the reason for the Enlightenment of the 1700s. So you get the Enlightenment following on the heels of this scientific revolution because of STEM. So you have people like Kant, Hume, Voltaire, all looking at what Newton did. And he's standing on the shoulders of giants, but man, he's a giant himself. And they're saying, good heavens, look at what humans can do. And look what they can do with reason, with mathematics, with the experimental method, as Hume calls it. And they actually, Hume actually tries, his whole philosophy is to model his entire thought project on Newton's experimental philosophy. I mean, he's explicit about that. And we can't understand Hume or Kant without understanding what was going on. So this is, again, this is something that's so critical in being able to integrate this seamlessly where you're not going, all right, here, guys, I'm going to talk about science during this class period. I'm going to talk about humanities during this class period. You kind of, it reminds me, of, I kind of think of this as a Trojan horse. You just kind of put it in sneak. I mean, like, you get to the end of the students' high school years, and they've learned so much STEM, and it's just been incorporated into their curriculum that it's steeped in them. And then they understand both humanities and STEM. Okay, so when it comes to another reason, it's the story of Western thought, and it actually continues. It didn't just stop then. I'll talk about that in a second. But we also have these fundamental assumptions, and I want to look at this just real briefly. What STEM allows us to understand, or what some of the fundamental assumptions behind STEM are that help us to see the big picture, that help us to see our place in the world, how God has created the world. I mean, the big part is this notion of divine design. We have, when it comes to calculus, when it comes to and its applicability to the world, when it comes to STEM, we have so many opportunities to say, look, there's no way any of this will work unless there's a divine designer. In fact, the historian of mathematics, Morris Klein, says that the scientific revolution, the folks in the scientific revolution, they had this Pythagorean, these three Pythagorean assumptions or ideas that were driving these guys in the scientific revolution. So here's what they are: this Pythagorean view. First, the universe is ordered by perfect mathematical laws. Divine reason is the organizer. This just didn't just happen. And here's another important thing, that human reason can discern this divine pattern. You don't get STEM without these. Now, we're living on the fumes of these, but what's interesting, and this is one of the things that we're finding, this whole revolution in design, looking at fine-tuning and evolution and all of that, is that you really do, you can't do science, you can't have science, you can't have these ideas or this continuity without having this Christian, these Christian underpinnings. And we need to teach our kids the details about that. So this is part of that. I mentioned some of this. Why would math work at all? I'm actually, one of a big research project of mine now is looking at the applicability of mathematics. I cannot stress how glorious this is. And this is one of the things that we need to get to our kids in detail, not just saying it, showing it. Even fundamental assumptions is why is there a big picture at all? Why do things fit together? Why is there a unified body of knowledge? We take so much for granted. The world could be so much more chaotic than it is and different from what it is. But everyone just thinks, yeah, well, no, that's just the way it is. And there's no reason, we don't need to have an explanation for it. So the very reason that STEM is a thing at all screams divine design. Okay, so this is not just a historical curiosity. We have a crisis today in physics, and I'll just go through this quickly. I'll teach you I'll cover all of physics. Remember, we talked about strings. Our two main pillars of physics are quantum mechanics and general relativity. One's about the very small, one's about the very large and very fast. But here's the problem. They contradict one another at certain places. They don't work well together. So you may have heard of string theory. String theory is very, very popular. It's been around for decades and decades. It's the replacement. It's what we're looking for. It's a theory of quantum gravity, where general relativity on the one hand is our theory of gravity now. We have quantum mechanics on the other hand, but we don't have a quantum theory of gravity. So something's really wrong. And physicists, this is a crisis today. Now, this quantum gravity, string theory is one of those. It's so, can you imagine what the Pythagoreans would be thinking? I told you it was strings. I told you. So that's one of the candidates. The problem is that it doesn't seem to have any empirical consequences that we can test. There was an article in October that said the number of possible string theories was roughly 10 to the power of 723. That's 723 zeros. That's how. So it's kind of like a theory of everything becomes a theory of anything. There's no way to discern it from anything else. So there's a real crisis here. It's not clear that string theory is going to be able to do. Maybe it will. Hard to see the future is, as Yoda said. But it's still, we don't know, and it doesn't look good. Adam Becker, he's a he's got this great book called What is Real? And he says this, the deep problems at the boundaries of physics, quantum gravity chief among them, have not yielded solutions for decades. Now, Lee Smolin, a guy who worked on string theory, says this, the problem is that there's this distinction between, he calls them craftseers, and or craftspeople and seers. I call them virtuosos and visionaries. You have people like that know their philosophy, the physicists who know their, they have this big picture overall view like Kant and, I mean, like Einstein and Bohr and Newton. And then you have the people who are the virtuosos when it comes to mathematics, let's say, or the physics. And they can do feats that are just out of this world when it comes to math. But they often don't go together. And so what Smolin says is the problem, the reason we're stymied in physics, or one of the reasons, I mean, it's hard, but the other reason is that we've separated STEM from humanities. And so we don't have these visionaries. That's what I want us, we are right there. I mean, this is such a great time for STEM and classical Christian education. So we need creativity just as much as we need the technical virtuosity. And those, you can't get, in fact, you can't have someone who's technical with, they often have to go together in order to really, really make those two work. Now, here's a quote by Einstein who's talking about this problem. And this may be where Smolin got his idea. Einstein says this, so many people today and even professional scientists seem to me like somebody who has seen thousands of trees but has never seen a forest. A knowledge of the historic and philosophical background gives the kind of independence from prejudices of his generation from which most scientists are suffering. This independence created by philosophical insight is, in my opinion, the mark of distinction between a mere artisan or specialist and a real seeker after truth. There you go, Einstein said it. Now, here, so a couple, let me give you four practical suggestions. And by the way, this is all merely just trying to get you on board and to see, look, here's some of the things that we need to do. If you see me walking around, talk to me, ask me. I'll be at either the New St. Andrews College booth or the Roman Roads booth. Ask them. They can contact. Whatever it is, I want to talk about this. There's lots to say. But the first thing is we need to give what are called HPS courses, History and Philosophy of Science. And it's so easy. There are resources to do this, where we can teach our students from the beginning these fundamental, the way STEM and humanities grew up together, and the fundamental assumptions behind science and about reality and about what we can know. All of that is just so critical, and it all goes together, which is what's so powerful. So history and philosophy of science. Another thing is, for example, I do this with physics, an overview of the current state of physics, where you teach students, I do this like in 8 weeks, an 8-week term. Look, here's what physics looks, here are the things we know, here are the things we don't, here's what physics is made up of, quantum mechanics and general relativity, what do these mean? And by the way, there's a good resource out there, one of the books that I use is called We Have No Idea. I wouldn't recommend it necessarily for the, I don't know, high school kids probably could, but it's got cartoons and all that, but I mean, there's a few rough parts, but it's so good because it reads like science fiction. The stuff that we're seeing and the way the world works is so mysterious that you're thinking, I don't know when to believe this, which is so fascinating. So overviews of, and you can do this with biology or whatever, but I think physics is so important because we're so scared and it's so fundamental. Another thing is to an integrated and efficient mathematics pedagogy. I'm going to be talking about this later, but This is something, this is very difficult. This is not easy at all. But integrating, say, the history and the historical and the conceptual aspects of mathematics into the mathematical, into the curriculum. Now, there are different ways to do that, but it's so crucial. And you have to figure out, not all concepts are equal. So you're going to have to leave some concepts out. And again, I think that's a good thing. But anyways, so getting mathematics doing better. And we have a long way to go, long ways to go. And the other is just consolidation and review courses when it comes to math and science. Again, that's related to the second one. We never get time to just step back and see, all right, here's how all this fits together. This is my fault. There was a meme. This was just last night. I was showing my son a meme. And it had a polar bear over here. You know, just a picture of a polar bear. And then next to it, it had a picture of this really artificial square bear called Cartesian bear. So there's polar bear and Cartesian bear. I'm like, Jared, check this out. You're going to love this. I mean, it's math. He's not going to love it. But anyways, he looked at it, and he just stared at it. He didn't get it. I saw him all year working with polar coordinates. He's like, what are Cartesian coordinates? What am I doing? I mean, that was an amazing insight. A little disappointing. But again, I mean, we're not after a perfect education. By the way, guys, there's no perfect education. There are good educations, there are better educations, and there are different ways of coming up with a good education. So don't chase the perfect. Don't be a perfectionist. However, just the fact that he's working with polar coordinates for a whole year or whatever. I mean, over the course of a year at different times, he just didn't understand the. So we need to have this kind of stepping back and saying, look, here's what we're doing. Here's the difference between these two. This is why we're using them. Remember, this is why trigonometry is about what? Triangles. Seriously, kids don't know that. Even after working with triangles. Okay, so those are some of the ways that we can work through this, and there's lots to do, but we are at such a wonderful, exciting place where there are small things that are going to yield enormous dividends. Okay, so it's very, very good. Now, we don't have a ton of time for questions, but if there are any, like if you think, well, that was all false, or I knew all of that, or anything in between. Anyone have any questions at all? Yes, sir.
You mentioned some resources. Are there any resources? Get that to their
teachers? Yeah, no, I think that's great. I think and I think that's the key, is getting us as educators first. And one of the things, there are a number of things. I would look at there's a book called Worldviews by a guy named DeWitt. It's an overview of the history and philosophy of science. It's very straightforward. He does a really good job. A shorter one is Oxford, Very Short Introduction to Philosophy of Science by a guy named Okasha. He does it's a little, you know, these are very short introductions. They are, by the way, avail yourself of some of those. They are so good. But the philosophy of science is a good one. When you start getting deeper, you might want to look. I mean, Thomas Kuhn is going to be the structure of scientific revolutions, but that's not an overview. That's more of a primary source, even though it's an older one. But there's two right there. And talk to me later. I've got a bunch of other ones as well. Yes, sir. Yeah, no, that's a good question. It's partly that. It's going to be that it's going to be looking at the philosophy of science. And this is one of the things that's so critical. None of this should work, but they should know why in very, very important details, where it's just, I mean, even when it comes to the fine-tuning of the universe, I mean, the things that have to come together in order to make even, I mean, we're not even talking about evolution. We're not talking about life. We're just talking about the universe. I mean, there are so many different ways that just scream design. So I think that's going to be a big one. Unity and diversity when it comes to the Trinity and all that, of course, but so much of it is going to be, and this is a longer conversation, but I think proper philosophy done well and done right and the right answer, just is a Christian philosophy. So and this is one of the things that we're just going to have to take a long time, the long term, is it's so unified that sometimes it's hard to point out the specifics, but then when you start seeing, well, shoot, that there's no way this could have been without this concept of God. So some specifics, but some general reminders as well. Yes, sir.
I struggle with trying to determine somewhere. So how do
you I think that, so here's, what an excellent question. That, you don't want to repeat, you don't want to go backwards. I mean, there's insights that you want to draw from them. Like I said, I wouldn't go back and go, hey, let's do the quadrivium and just do, let's try. Too much has happened. We know too much now. Now we know there's a lot to learn, of course. But there are resources out there now where people, and I mentioned this Oxford Interdisciplinary, I mean, there's a lot of resources, and we can talk about this afterwards, where they're taking the big picture of things, and distilling them. And that's one of the things that I do in my career is to try to, I mean, that's a big part of my research in my career is to figure out what sorts of things are insightful from the past and that we can learn and we see the roots, but then how does that apply today to like quantum gravity and quantum field theory or particles or, you know, dark matter or gravitational waves or whatever it is or evolution. And one of the things we do is we as teachers have to learn the big picture, but there are resources out there now that can do that. So it really is just directing people to those resources. There's good stuff. And again, if email me too. I mean, email Roman, I mean, whoever it is, get to me and I will respond because there's lots of good stuff. Did you have a question? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I think you can teach it in such a way that it would be junior high on, and it would depend on which resources that you use. Certainly high school, and it can be just part. This, and again, we can talk about this later. There's a way to integrate this because we only have so much time in a day, but there's a way to do. I mean, I just did a series of lectures for a humanities course where we covered the Enlightenment. So my part was the Enlightenment. It was so much about just STEM. So you do it both at the same time, so you're not, and it's not an artificial way of doing that. I mean, it really isn't ad hoc or hokey. You can just tell the story of the Enlightenment and you end up doing philosophy of science. All right, well, I gotta let you go. Thanks so much for being here. Catch me anyways, and we'll see you.